Ready to proceed?
My name is Edmund Johnson, and I represent First USA National Bank, which is now an arm of J.P. Morgan Bank and Trust. This case involves putative leases for short-term rentals, for short-term rental apartments. It involves three leases with terms running from 5 to 7.5 years. If valid, the three leases would have obligated First USA to pay plaintiffs $30 million. In other words, these are very large transactions. Because the leases at issue were for terms greater than 1 year, and because they passed an interest in real estate, the leases at issue were subject to the Delaware Statute of Frauds. A contract subject to the Delaware Statute of Frauds must be memorialized in writing and signed by the party to be charged. If a contract subject to the Statute of Frauds is signed by someone else on behalf of a party to be charged, the authority of that person to sign for the party to be charged must appear in writing. The jury found that the leases were signed or entered into on behalf of First USA by a young lady with the title of Relocation Coordinator. Because the Relocation Coordinator was not authorized in writing to enter into contracts subject to the statute of frauds, such as those at issue in this case, it is First USA's position that the leases are invalid and that that First USA was entitled to summary judgment on that issue.
Two questions, Mr. Johnson. Is there a case that squarely holds that when a corporation is a party to an agreement, that whoever signs for the corporation has to have written authorization?
I think there are at least two here in Delaware, Your Honor. One is the Chernow versus McCall, which we cited in our brief. And a second is Jones versus BP Oil Company, which is a Court of Chancery decision, which directly held that an employee of BP Oil Company who had the title of real estate specialist had to be, that he could not enter into an agreement to transfer an interest in land unless he had authority in writing.
Is it your position that all of the leases here have to have the same formality, resolutions, authorizations that a deed would require?
Yes, I think that's true. Or any other interest in land which is passed. There's a limitation on the interest in land. A lease for a residential lease for up to 1 year is expressly accepted from the statute of frauds. But if it's over a year on a residential lease, then it is subject to the statute for two reasons. One, because it passes an interest in land for more than 1 year, and second, because it is more than 1 year, which is a second prong of the statute.
So if the CEO were to sign for the corporation on the written lease, that would also require some sort of written authorization, correct?
There is an exception that was announced by this court in Farrell v. Hessler. Certainly for the CEO, and they went on to say for the principal executive officers of a corporation, that such people have inherent authority to execute contracts, including contracts subject to the statute of frauds. So that is an exception to the rule, or an exception to the statute of frauds, specifically made by this court.
Just a factual question.
Yes.
With respect to the leases that are contested here, at the time that your client took the position that the leases were a nullity, had all of the rents been paid, that is, that it accrued on those leases?
They had not, and the rental history.
And were they later at some point? But what I'm really asking is, are we talking about future? Is an issue here just future rents or future rents plus some past rents?
All right. The damages calculation, and I don't know why the plaintiffs below did this, but the plaintiffs decided for their own reasons only to seek rents in the future. In other words, the issue was joined in the year 2000. The letter from Mr. Boardman came out in September of 2000. First USA took the position that they were on a month-to-month basis on these things. They paid for all of the apartments that they had actually occupied, but refused to pay for apartments that they had not occupied. And there would have been a few months there, October, November, and December, that could have been subject to this. But they just went forward in their damage calculation from 2001 forward.
So as far as the record shows, what's at issue are units that, I mean, to the best of everyone's ability, units that were not occupied.
And not occupied by First USA personnel.
By USA, yes.
Well, that actually isn't quite accurate either, because there were a couple of apartments, a couple of people didn't get the message,
right. And
remained in the apartments through 2001. We weren't aware of that until we went to mediation, and that was brought to our attention, and then we had to take care of that. But
that was paid for.
My understanding is that was paid for, yes. That was either paid for or included in the damages. It may have been included in the damages, or a portion of it may have been. The portion that was not paid for would have been included in the damages. At any rate, First USA moved for summary judgment in the trial court on that issue, and the trial court denied the motion, holding that the written authority requirement only applies to third-party agents, whatever that may be, and not employees. I think the court was making a distinction between employees and agents who were not employees of the corporation. But there's nothing in the statute that would distinguish employee agents from non-employee agents. Consequently, there's no statutory basis for the Superior Court's ruling. And as we discussed just a few minutes ago, there is the exception that is in Farrell v. Hessler, and the Superior Court seems to have based its holding on the reasoning, at least, of Farrell v. Hessler. As I pointed out a few minutes ago, Farrell v. Hessler's exception was only for the principal executive officers of a corporation. The court below expanded that to any employee, and that decision is directly contrary to the ruling of the Court of Chancery in Jones versus BP Oil Company, which I mentioned before, and which is in both of our briefs. So it is our view that because the ruling below on First USA's motion for summary judgment is not supported by the statute or the rulings of this court, that the ruling should be reversed. Now, despite the requirement of the statute of frauds that authority must appear in writing for contracts of this sort, the court below sent the issue of authority to the jury without any mention of the written authority requirements of the statute. The jury instructions on authority were generic in the sense that they were not adjusted to address any statutory requirements.
Well, yeah, let me just make it so that I understand where you are. Your first argument is that because there was no written authority for Ms. Constant, then the statute of frauds mandates that these leases are all invalid. Secondly, even if that isn't the case, there was not sufficient evidence to create a triable jury question as to whether there was implied in fact authority on Ms. Constant's part. Is that your position?
That is the first half of it. We have two. One is that there was no evidence on which you could send to the jury. There was no issue of fact to be decided by the jury on whether there was implied authority, because implied authority is that authority which the agent reasonably believes she had as a result of the acts of the principal.
Well, there are three kinds of authority.
Yes.
There's express authority that could either take the form of a written instrument, which you argue for, or an oral agreement. There's implied in fact authority, which is authority that arises out of the position that the particular agent has, and that is reasonably implied in the circumstances as a factual matter. And then there's apparent authority, which is no authority at all, but simply an estoppel concept. We're talking about the second category.
We're talking about the second category, and I think there are two sides to the second category of implied. And while I'm not sure that the courts have made this distinction expressly, they seem to look at, when you have a president of a corporation or something of that sort, they talk about that as being inherent authority, which is one form of implied authority. And when you have the sort of authority which is necessary to do whatever it is that the agent was told to do or was asked to do, and is necessary and practically essential to carry that out, that is implied authority.
My question is, why is this not a factual issue, where the argument is that there's no basis for the jury to decide an implied in fact question. That is, if it isn't by some nature a factual question, then what is it?
Well, it is a factual question, but there has to be a factual issue that's in dispute in order to have a factual issue to send to the jury. If the standard is, and it's my understanding that the standard is, that the implied authority of the sort that we're talking about here is that authority which the agent reasonably believes that she has based upon the acts of the principal, in other words, what the principal told her to do. And the example of that that was used in the jury instructions is if someone is given the job of maintaining the facilities of a corporation, that they have implied authority to buy cleaning materials because it's essential to the job. You have to be able to do it. And here, this person had a job which was to get, among other things, short-term housing for employees who were being relocated.
Well, let's cut to this. You're saying, yes, it is a factual issue, but there weren't enough facts to warrant taking the issue to the jury. Is that
That's
right?
Correct, because the only facts...
What's the missing fact as a legal matter? I mean, what are we looking for here?
Yes. If the standard is the reasonable belief of the agent, the only place that you can find out what the agent believed was from the agent themselves. And the agent in this case testified that she did not have authority to enter into contracts of this size and never asked anybody for authority to enter into contracts of this size and had no reason to believe that she ever would be able to get such authority.
I thought your argument was that implied authority never trumps the statute of frauds.
That's one of the two arguments that we have under implied authority.
Well, let's get that straight, because that's exactly what was going through my mind when Justice Ridgely asked it. Why would the jury have had any issue before it, and you say they did not have this issue before it, other than was there existing written authority for this person to enter into the leases or not? Implied authority is not an issue in a case with the statute of frauds.
That is our position, exactly. And that was never put before the jury because the court resolved that issue against us on summary judgment on the basis of the fact that an employee signed the agreement and he felt that that is sufficient. And that took the case out of the statute of frauds.
So that's the error we should be focused on. Not whether or not there were sufficient facts to support an issue of implied authority going to the jury or whether the instruction in that regard was correct or incorrect.
Very well, Your Honor. I think that is true.
Well, it's a question. It's not a statement.
Well, no, I think that is true. That really is our major issue here is, one, that you have a statute that requires written authority, and two, that while it has never been addressed directly by the courts of this state, in other states where, outside of the Farrell v. Hessler situation, in other states where they have addressed that directly, they have held that in a case under the statute of frauds, the concepts of implied and apparent authority have no use. It cannot be used to trump the statute.
Was there any partial performance that would take this case out of the statute of frauds, and was that a jury issue?
Yeah, first, that was not put to the jury. Second, the part performance doctrine can only be used in the case of an oral contract, and there was no oral contract here. This was a written contract that they were relying on, and you'll find that in both the Cherno versus McCall and BP Oil versus Jones versus BP Oil, that same issue came up. People were raising the issue of a written contract, and this court held, and the Chancery Court held, that because it was not an oral agreement, that the part performance doctrine had no place. Third, the jury never looked at this issue, and there is a factual argument which we made in our reply brief, which I would refer you to because it gets mildly complex. But there was no evidence on which you could find part performance in any event. Part performance doctrine requires clear and convincing evidence, and the evidence that which they relied on was a number of paid invoices, but they did not refer to the leases in any way, and they were identical to the invoices that had been sent for the many, many months before that, where First USA was renting apartments on a month-to-month basis.
But that goes really to my first factual question. Are you saying that there's no basis on which a fact finder could conclude from this record that rents were paid on the leases in question?
That's right. Until the issue came to a head and First USA repudiated the leases, or however you want to refer to that, there was nothing on the bills that were sent did not refer to leases in any way.
But we know now, don't we, were paid.
Not on the leases. That was on apartments that were actually occupied by First USA, but not on the leases themselves.
They were occupied, from your position, on a month-to-month basis, not pursuant to a lease.
That's correct. And we made the payments based upon the fact that we had been regularly renting from them on a month-to-month basis for many, many months, years, actually.
You're in your rebuttal time. Did you want to save it?
I would like to save it if I could, but if you have questions, I would answer those too.
May it please the court.
Good morning.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justice Ridgely, I'm James Green. I represent the appellees who are Brand Park, Inc. and several other corporations related to and controlled by the Pettinaro family. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here. In my humble opinion, this appeal revolves around one legal issue, but it's really a fact-dominant case. This was a jury trial. It was tried very hard. There were lots of motions in limine. There were lots of summary judgment motions, but really this issue is, I suggest, not whether a Cherno versus McCall or Jones versus BP Oil control this case. The statute has an or in it, and this court has clearly said in Hessler versus Farrell that that or has meaning. A third party agent must have written authority. A person, or in this case a corporation, does not necessarily have to have written authority. Hessler makes that clear. I respectfully submit that the case is controlled by Hessler, and there actually are two other cases in this jurisdiction, both lower court cases, which have followed Hessler on similar fact patterns, one in Chancery Court and one in the Superior Court. And the question is this: does the application of the principle of law decided by Hessler depend upon the title or position of the person in the corporation, or does it depend upon the authority delegated to the corporate actor?
Quick question.
Yes, sir.
If the requirement of a writing does not apply to employees of the corporation, as distinguished from third-party agents, that would leave open, at least theoretically, the possibility of authority being established either under the implied authority in fact or the apparent authority doctrine. Mr. Johnson argues that apparent authority has been precluded as a matter of law by the statute. Do you agree or disagree?
Apparent authority. I'm not sure that I would agree, Your Honor, but I would say that since the jury in this case didn't find apparent authority, I'm not sure that it matters.
But you would agree, would you not, that the implied in fact authority doctrine does apply?
I believe it clearly does, and I believe Hessler says it clearly does.
All right. The test for that type of authority, according to First USA, is the reasonable belief of the putative agent. Is that the test?
Well, it is not the reasonable belief of the putative agent. It's the authority which is necessary, usual, and proper to effectuate the main authority which is delegated. And that, in other words, in this specific case, there is no question that Melissa Counselor was delegated by the highest levels of First USA Bank, Richard Vague, who was the CEO, Mr. Barr, who was next in line, and Mr. Tripoli. The latter of two testified at trial. Her job was to find housing for the hundreds of people they were bringing to Delaware, 70 a month. All they told her was, get housing for those people. She thereafter, not only she, but her subordinate, entered into scores of leases, submitted the bills totaling many millions of dollars to First USA's accounting department, and they were paid without question for a period of about 4 years until this case came up. So the implied authority of an officer or agent of a corporation includes the authority that is incidental and necessary and usual to effectuate the main authority.
Would that include the authority to enter into a 99-year lease?
I would have to say I don't know, Your Honor. If properly delegated by the corporation, if that was her job, then I would say yes, it would. I have to tell you, I don't know the necessary requirements, seals, etc., for a 99-year lease, but because I think it has different ramifications from a real estate point of view than a 5-year lease, as was the case in these. But I would say yes, under the authority of Hessler and what I just quoted from Williston, that implied authority, in fact, includes whatever is necessary to effectuate your main authority. And in this case, there is no question that her authority was delegated plenary authority to get the housing necessary. All of their witnesses testified that yes, that no officer of this corporation had any authority granted in writing, that Mr. Vague, who was the CEO, wanted things done and he didn't want questions asked, and her job was to find housing.
So the argument that this issue turns on the existence or non-existence of a reasonable subjective belief on Ms. Constant's part is not correct. You're saying this is an objective determination based on facts and circumstances.
Yes, sir. And I believe that's what Hessler says. It is the law of this state that when in the usual course of the business of a corporation, an officer or agent has been allowed to manage certain of its affairs, and when this is known to the other party to the contract, the authority of the officer to act for the corporation is implied from the past conduct, never challenged by corporate officials. Which is a little bit different. In any event, Your Honor, and I can point to the transcript, on cross-examination, I asked Ms. Counselor, would you have signed these? Let me digress for a moment. It was the position of First USA from the day this case was started that she never signed the leases. And that was an issue that went specifically to the jury. I have the jury instructions. They were specifically instructed. Do you find that she executed each of these leases? And they answered in special interrogatories, yes, she signed every one of them. So they approached it from a tactical point of view that these leases were never even signed. But when I had her on cross-examination, I said, does that appear to be your signature? Yes. Does that appear? Yes. Does that appear? She agreed she didn't remember signing, but they looked like her signatures. And I said, would you have signed those leases without proper authority? And she said, no, I wouldn't. The one person who never testified, well, there are two people key to this case that never testified, the CEO at the time, Mr. Vague, and the CEO who, more than a year down the road, repudiated those leases and told Mr. Pettinaro, I don't want them anymore. But I suggest, Your Honors, that if, as in Hessler, the title of the officer controls whether a corporation can execute a document or take an action within the statute of frauds, cannot depend on the officer's title, but must depend on the authority delegated. Otherwise, a corporation could studiously delegate authority to underlings who have titles like relocation coordinator, and then pick and choose which contracts it wanted to keep and which contracts it wanted to throw out, as in this case. First USA had occupied, used, and paid millions of dollars of rent to my clients from 1977 through the end of 2000 on leases executed by Ms. Counselor for apartments they occupied, and they never questioned it. There was one dramatic piece of testimony where Ms. Counselor was in a car with Ms. Wilkinson, who was the leasing manager at Pettinaro, and she said, Melissa, you know, you're behind $641,000 in rent. And Ms. Counselor got on a cell phone and called Columbus, Ohio, and said, you need to wire this money. It was in the bank account the next day. This is not a person who is so far down the corporate chain that she doesn't have authority to bind the corporation.
Does she bear the risk of lack of authority? I mean, should it be the buyer's responsibility to demand a corporate resolution or a prospective tenant's responsibility to demand a corporate resolution, or it should be the seller or the lessor's responsibility to produce that?
I think it depends, Your Honor, without dodging the question. at what stage you are in. If you're at day one, and Melissa Counselor comes, and this was essentially day one, and said, I want to enter into a lease for 30 units at $75,000 a unit, and that happened on April 1, 1998, and she signed it, and Pettinaro signed it, and then they delivered 30 units and started collecting $75,000 a month rent. At that point, back then, I would say that's probably caveat emptor. Let the lessor check that out, because she may not have authority. But 2 years down the road, after millions of dollars are paid, many contracts are signed, then the pattern changes. And to allow the corporation to get out on a fact pattern like that, I believe turns the statute of frauds on its head.
Moving away from the statute of frauds and to an issue that Mr. Johnson didn't have time to get to, why is the Rockwood lease enforceable?
The Rockwood lease, and Your Honor asked Mr. Johnson about that. There's no part performance. There was clearly reliance by Pettinaro. The lease was signed in 1999. Pettinaro started designing and constructing the building. And there are two issues that they make. One, it's not enforceable, because here, clearly, there was not part performance, and for the same reasons, the statute of frauds. The second reason is that there were the units were not sufficiently defined.
That's the argument that I'm focusing on. Okay. That is that the instrument is too vague to legally convey anything.
Well, my first response to that, Your Honor, is that is a fact question. There was an instruction to the jury that a contract to be legally enforceable must be sufficiently defined to allow both parties to know what they are committing to, how that can be enforced.
But for there to be a fact question, there has to be at least one reasonable construction of the Rockwood lease that would not be vague. What would that construction be here?
The location was not vague, that they would be...
The location, there was no Queensbury Village, if that's the proper name.
At the time, the zoning, and Mr. Pettinaro covered this in cross-examination by Mr. Johnson's colleague, that he took him through the whole, from the purchase of the property to the naming of the property to the zoning of the property to the rezoning for apartments, and it was a specific location. He actually took him to the railroad tracks and to Route 40 and where it was. So at the time the lease was entered into, Queensbury was a place defined by zoning maps and zoned for apartments. So there was a location, Your Honor. It was later changed to, the name was later changed to Rockwood. There was a square footage, there was a price, there was a designation that they would be apartments, which Mr. Pettinaro testified.
Well, the location had to be established by extrinsic evidence, correct? Because there's nothing in the lease.
It was not in the lease. That is absolutely right, Your Honor.
Okay, and the extrinsic evidence showed what? Was there a development,
yes,
plot
there was
plan?
A development, a subdivision plan, a rezoning that had been submitted, rezoning for apartment. It was originally single-family homes, and Pettinaro, or Rockwood VL Corporation, had it rezoned to apartments. And it was thereafter that the lease was executed.
The argument that you're confronted with is that because the lease didn't, on its face, give enough information as to location or as to precisely what kind of apartments were going to be leased, that it was facially invalid. Your response is it's a fact question. How do we decide that?
Well, I believe the cases say that this court must give great deference to the finding of a jury on an issue that was charged.
Assuming that it's properly submitted to the jury, but let's first talk about the threshold question of whether it can be submitted.
Well, that also, I as I understand the case law, Your Honor, is a matter left to the sound discretion of the trial judge, and the trial judge had the written contracts, listened to the evidence, including the evidence which I just alluded to, and additional evidence about how through this course of dealing at Narrow had always supplied apartments which had been suitable to First USA, hundreds of apartments.
Well, the court below may not have discretion to submit an issue to the jury that's not a fact issue. And that's what we're grappling with here, whether this is a legal or a fact issue.
I understand that, Your Honor.
Do you have a case that validates a lease of the kind involved here?
I don't have a lease case, Your Honor. The cases that we've cited, there's the one from the Third Circuit, which involved a boxing promotion contract. I don't have a specific lease case. I don't think the appellant has one either. I'm not aware of one, Your Honor.
I'd like to ask you a question about the transfer tax issue.
Absolutely.
What is the amount of the transfer tax that would be due upon recording of these leases?
Well,
approximately.
If they were recorded ab initio, it would be, I think, 1.5% for a state tax and 1.5% for a county tax. Two of the leases are only involved, Your Honor. The combined lease, which is the one that was occupied and the security deposit was paid and the rent was paid for a year afterwards, in which we argue it was part performance as well, did not have to be recorded because it was not deemed to be more than 5 years. The other two leases, one which there was no finding of damages on, the Harbor Place lease and the Rockwood lease, were for 5 years, but Judge Silverman ruled that because the contract was signed before the 5 years started, they exceeded 5 years, so they were recordable. I believe the total rental on those was if you know all the rent was paid for 5 years, was probably close to $2 million. My math isn't very good, but that would probably be $600,000, 3%.
$600,000 is 3% of $2 million?
$20 million. Did I say $2 million? I'm sorry.
Yeah, just
it would be. It
make
would
sure
be
you calculate dollars. Before you pay the tax.
I'll have somebody check on your accounts.
My follow-up question is, when is a lease being enforced for purposes of that statute? Is it being enforced by going to trial? Is it being enforced by entry of judgment? Is it being enforced by execution on the judgment?
I would say the last of the three, Your Honor, and anecdotally, and I think it's important to understand from the trial court's perspective, these two leases were denied to exist from day one by the appellant. And they said, these do not exist, and I believe the judge did the proper thing by saying, well, if they don't exist, if you don't have any interest in that land, why should they file and pay taxes on them? Let us do that when they need to be enforced. And I believe they did not need to be enforced, or he would not be called upon to enforce them until the jury found that they were valid leases. Now, this is not part of the record, but as an officer of the court, after the verdict was entered, we went to the county to record this Rockwood lease, and they said, no, there was no transfer of possession. They don't need to be recorded. The county got legal opinions from the state and the county revenue departments.
So there's no transfer tax or recording?
They wouldn't take the recording, and they wouldn't charge us a tax. So that's the ironic thing about that whole issue. Their position was, the county's position was, and the state's position was, transfer of possession triggers that. And the cases that held, and the one was a draconian result, as I recall it, a 7 year, people were in a place for 7 years, and the lease was nullified because it had never been recorded. But there they had taken possession, had lived there. And really, that statute is a transfer statute. It's designed to make sure that people don't have, like Your Honor said earlier, a 99-year lease, which is really a sale, to avoid transfer tax. And when we went to record them, the state said, there's no transfer, therefore, no tax. I lost my train of thought, I'm sorry. I think my time is about up. If there are other questions, I would conclude by saying, Mr. Johnson says that this case is dominated by the statute of frauds. I think this case is dominated by the facts, and the facts at trial were overwhelming. That Ms. Counselor was given full authority to enter into these leases, and they live by at least one of them for a year before they decided they didn't want them again. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Green.
I'd like to respond to just a couple items that were mentioned. I think one of the members of the court asked who should bear the risk of lack of authority. I think that under Delaware law, there's a number of cases, and we cited them in our opening brief, including Z versus Atlas Powder Company, which is a decision of this court, which say that a party that does business with an agent does so at his peril, and it is up to him to determine the authority of the agent. And I think that anyone who has been involved in a real estate transaction that involves a bank will know that the bank immediately wants to see a resolution of the board of directors that allows the people to enter into this. You always, in fact, they even have sample ones that they'll give to you to have the board of directors sign. It's not a huge imposition on people, and it's something which is required by the statute of frauds. I also think that the argument that was made by Mr. Green, which was that at the outset, it should be the risk should be on the person doing business with the agent, and later on that risk shifts. That's an apparent authority risk. That argument is that as you've done more and more business, you have reason to believe that you can do business with them. And I think that in a sense that is what apparent authority does, except in this case, the jury rejected.
Well, it could also be implied in fact authority the other side's part, an acquiescence by your client in that implied authority, could it not?
I think that in a proper case, you can get there. I think there's actually three different ways that you get there. That is really a ratification argument, I think. Once you know about a transaction that was entered into by an agent and you take the benefits or go along with it, you may have ratified the transaction.
Well, only First USA is the principal can ratify the agent's lack of authority, but your client can't ratify anything. It can only acquiesce in that agent's status as an implied, in fact, agent.
So I don't think that my client can establish her authority unless she's given authority to do so. In other words, you have to look to acts of the principal in order to establish the agent's authority.
And those are factual, aren't they? The acts of the principal?
The acts of the principal are generally fact issues, yes. I wouldn't disagree with that. There was a question asked about Queensbury Village, and there was a discussion about Queensbury Village. It's the first time I've heard that particular argument. There were no citations to the record. I think you will find that while there was zoning activity and changes to the zoning made on that over a period of time, it's very important to know what the timing is, because this is 1999, and when changes were made makes a difference, and whether the name Queensbury Village was used also makes a difference, and whether the records that we're talking about are available to the public make a difference. But the fact of the matter is that the testimony of plaintiff's witness in this case was that the only people who knew where Queensbury Village was or what it was were the Petnoms, or the plaintiffs in this case. And we cite to that testimony in our brief. I have one other thing that I need to clear up for you, because there is a mistake in our brief. We have a mistaken citation, and I want to clear that up on the record. In our brief, and this goes to the Queensbury Village issue, we say that the course of dealing could not remedy the fact that the document does not identify the location of Queensbury Village. The record was clear that neither of the negotiators had ever been there. And we erroneously cite on page 9 of our opening brief that to A164, page 34. That's an incorrect citation. It's actually A165, page 39. But the testimony is there. It's just at A165, page 39. And I wanted to make that clear. And if you're looking for the testimony that I just cited, that the only people who knew what the term Queensbury Village meant were the plaintiffs, that's at A167, page 46 to 47.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.